Hello and welcome to another special edition T20 World Cup qualifier podcast here with Tim Cutler and Bertus Jong. We've just watched Scotland take the fifth and second last spot on offer at the T20 World Cup next year in 2020 in Australia. Now, last night, well, I could say yesterday, the UAE were blasted away by the Netherlands pace attack. I think it's fair to say today we saw them swept away. I'm stealing Peter De La Penna's headline from his article, but he won't listen, I'm sure. They were swept away by the bat of George Munsey. He made 65 from 43 deliveries in a, well, insurmountable, but probably 50 runs too many in the end, even to put it beyond doubt, when they made 198 for 6, and the UAE in reply were bowled out for 108 in the 19th over. Other notable scores in that batting lineup from Scotland was Kyle Kurtzer, who made 34 at around even time opening up, but then Richie Barrington just missed out on, well, getting his half century. He was out for 48 from 18 balls, but he was only a couple of balls outside of what would have been the potentially fastest half century ever at a global qualifier. That was scored by Paul Sterling in 2012, but he was out for 48 off 18 balls. Bertus, we spoke about this, well, both today and yesterday, as to whether we feared that the UAE had run their race, almost had their final in getting this far. Have you changed your mind at all from that perspective?
Not so much. I mean, it was an absolute mauling, really. Going ahead into the game, I did pick Scotland to win it. I didn't maybe pick them to win it quite so convincingly. Putting on nearly 200 on a track that wasn't necessarily the easiest batting wicket, actually. Munsey finally firing the way that we always know that he could. And Barrington just absolutely brutal on a hot afternoon, making the UAE players chase the ball to all corners. And I mean, I think really the less said about the second innings, the better. Although maybe we should say a bit, because that's the point of this whole podcast.
There's only so much that can be kind of...
The Emirates were gone almost from the first over. You saw they were coming out swinging, and Chirag Suri skying one after having a thick top edge going for four, and then the next one went straight up. They never really looked like threatening. And I mean, you can criticize some of the shot selection and you criticize some of the batting, but when you need 12 and over after the power play, I mean, on a wicket like that and on a day like today, I think you pretty much forget it. I think you could have called Mark Watt getting three or four wickets pretty much after as soon as the power play was done.
We've seen some amazing innings from Mohammad Usman throughout the tournament. He only managed 20 today, but the key man that we knew had to fire if UAE were going to be anywhere close was Rohan Mustafa, which we saw, I got the feeling he bowled really well in the power play, was bowling fast and full. Munsey was struggling to sweep and reverse sweep. But he came back to bowl the last over of the innings and it must have been close to 20, and just seemed to be bowling either length balls that were being slog swept or a full toss that I think it might have been McLeod got inside of and scooped over the man short on at fine leg on the circle. And then I think, you know, he's a confidence player, and even when he was coming out to bat, he just didn't have he wasn't carrying himself like a man that was about to win the game for his country. He came out and he was only out for four, I think, four off four balls. It's tough, isn't it, when you've got a man that's such a fighter like that, but such a confidence player. But he has had a great tournament overall, really, hasn't he?
Yeah, like you say, I mean, Scotland were 46 for none after the power play, which is, you'd tell you're pretty happy with that. But I think, yeah, that Mustafa's two overs in that power play, as you say, bowling a full length and quite flat, only went for a handful of runs. And it's a bit strange, in fact, that he didn't stick with that tactic at the death. Although, yeah, by then, even a good last couple of overs for the UAE, unlikely to have kept Scotland to anything chaseable. But yeah, the change of tactics was strange. You think bowling to a player like McLeod, I think the same tricks as bowling to a player like Munsey, you would back them to work. So that, yeah, those last couple of overs from Mustafa were fairly strange, I think. With the bat, I mean, he did not come out, as you say, like a man who thought he was going to win the game in front of a home, I guess crowd is generous, but a home smattering of spectators. He looked like a man who'd just spent another hour and a half in the sweltering sun and was not loving his cricket.
I want to pick up on that point briefly. You know, cricket has been played in the Netherlands for a long, long time, but we've seen one-day internationals and T20Is played there to maybe hundreds of fans. At most, I'm just looking at him for... We've only got the one microphone here, so I'll give you his reaction as I'm talking. It really is disappointing to see the UAE in these crunch matches, and I know it's a work day, and I know the demographic of a lot of the cricketers that are here that will be working and not be able to take days off. But gee, if you're the ECB or the Emirates Cricket Board, not the England and Wales Cricket Board here, but if you're the ECB or the ICC, you've got to be asking questions as to how we can get a not only an atmosphere in the stadium, but to get a little bit more interest around the event, surely.
Yeah, I mean, good points there. It comes down to promotion. It's really simple as that. As you say, usually when the Dutch have a home ODI or a home T20, even at the weekends, sometimes in Amsterdam or Rotterdam, where you think people could get along to it, you see, yeah, maybe a couple of hundred people tops. But you can do better, and they have done better in the past. When I remember one of the first games I covered for the Dutch was when the South Africans were over. A few years back, and there were temporary stands up. There was a crowd, must have been pushing 3,000-4,000 people, or going even further back. You know, 50 years ago, you'd have crowds in the thousands in the Netherlands, and it's the same thing here. There are people who will come and watch this. It's a work day, but you know, this is a big city, and there's not a lot of free entertainment on. But you go walk around Dubai, and we saw that there was, you know, we stumbled across flyers for the Red Bull campus cricket competition. But we've seen nothing outside of just a banner outside the ICC offices here and a banner outside the stadium. If you don't drive past that, you might not know this tournament's going on.
Yeah, it's good you mentioned that. Funny enough, in the fog of... Was it yesterday evening or the night before, actually? the Irish bar adjacent to the Player Hotel. Sounds a bit dodgy, us being there, hanging around near the Player Hotel. I promise we had permission. But going to the main event, shall we say, and yes, somewhat biased from this particular podcast's perspective, but there is one spot left, one position at a World Cup up for grabs, and it will either be Hong Kong or Oman. We know what Hong Kong has been through, losing three of their best 11 players before the series when they decided to make themselves unavailable after they weren't happy with the non-selection of a certain veteran player. Former captain Anshuman Rath, recently registered as a local player in India to be playing Ranji Trophy, etc., and we hope to see his name in the IPL auction as a local, and it will be a uncapped international player, which again is a bit of a head scratcher, but great for him, and for him to get a chance in the IPL would be amazing. But the as it is here, we've got a matchup that on paper is only going to go one way. Hong Kong and Oman have played in seven T20 internationals since the back end of 2015. Hong Kong has only won one of those. And that rivalry, or should we say maybe so having the wood over Hong Kong, goes back before they were playing T20Is and also in non-ODI 50-over matches. I think I wrote in the review of the Nigeria game, Hong Kong have come through with a wet sail through the storms of tumult. And for them to get to this position is amazing anyway. How do you see them going tonight, Bertus?
Yeah, Tim, I think that's a really good point. you know, if we go back to, you know, what we were talking about before the tournament started and picking our favourites, a lot of us Associates Cricket crew were looking at Oman as a maybe a smart punter's bet to take the whole tournament, looking at where they are now. And can compare that to Hong Kong, who, yeah, they were in crisis heading in here. Their preparation was disappointing, and yet here we are in an eliminator playoff, and there's only one of these teams that is happy to be here. And we've seen teams colossally underperform, and the captains will come out in the press conference and say that, you know, there's a lot of positive attitudes in there. They're, you know, they're excited to take on the next game, but The way that we've seen some teams perform in this tournament, it's clear that there's a lot of tired heads out there.
Yes, and hopefully you've read the report on emergingcricket.com from their shellacking last night by Namibia. But if you're Hong Kong, you're definitely watching that performance and really trying to mirror it. Hong Kong probably have some similar firepower and structure, or maybe even lack of structure, similar to what Namibia have. Now, they don't have a JJ Smith coming in down the order, but what they do have is the, I say dependable, but he's also been scoring at a good rate and also taking wickets, is Kinshit Shah, who's been their standout player, and they have the likes of Nazakat Khan up the top of the order, who could really take the game away from an Oman. And I think the only option really, well, I think the best option for Hong Kong is just to look what Namibia did, is to put the runs on the board, saving wickets in hand for the back half of the innings. But in Hong Kong's case, is to take advantage of Nazakat. They've got to get through the 8 overs of spin, turning away from the bat from Kalim and from Kawa Ali. They've historically had the wood over Hong Kong. But then really just to get a score on the board of 150 plus, I know it sounds easy if you say it quickly, but then really just turn the screws as they did to Jersey. And you might say, well, why are you mentioning Jersey so if they haven't gone through? But don't forget that Jersey team actually beat Oman in the last group game, meaning that Oman had to go into the crossovers as opposed to getting that automatic spot, which went to Ireland after Oman went down to Jersey. How are you seeing this one panning out, Bertus?
Yeah, I mean, there's every chance when you have players with the quality of Nazakat at the top of the order, and the way that Kinshit's come along just in the last year or so. But there's, as you say, there's a big difference between the Namibian lineup and what Hong Kong have. They don't have a JJ Smith coming in down the order. They cannot afford to have the same start that Namibia had. And then look to go big late, because they don't have that that lineup that clears the ropes all the way down to 8 and 9. So you're looking to Kinshit hopefully to come good, and for Nazakat to come off at the top, and then back it up with score. You know, with runs on the board, we've seen how the UAE went today. Now that's a monster of the total, but I don't think you need 200 runs on the board to be able to apply the kind of pressure that Scotland applied today. I think they could have won the game the same way with 160 on the board. And I think Hong Kong, we've seen how inconsistent Oman have been through this tournament. I think anything north of 150 is going to make Hong Kong favourites at the break if they do bat first.
And the way that Gerhard Erasmus used his bowlers, he brought himself on and to take the pace off, as we were talking about this morning, I thought was a masterstroke. Maybe it was reacting to the fact that Christy Villon had been taken to the cleaners, went for 14 from his first over, was brought back from the other end and went for 16. I think that was 72 for odd in the end of the power play, and really motoring, and then brought himself and Bernard Schultz on, who both bowled really, really well. Schultz bowled one of the better spells. He's got such an easy, and it's a little bit of a cliche these days, but a repeatable action that is really a, I don't know, you'd almost take it as a carbon copy if you're trying to teach someone to bowl spin with an easy action to replicate. Very impressive from both. And Erasmus in the press conference, I'm really impressed with how balanced he is for a young guy, and he's early 20s still. Law degree, working with his father. His father, Francois, former Namibian board member and also former ICC director for Associates. I think they're a real smoky to win this entire tournament now. They're probably the team of the four that you don't want to be coming up against. Maybe if it's a quick wicket and you've got the fast bowling of the Netherlands, maybe that's a team that you wouldn't want to face. But overall, across the park, they're the ones that you're wondering, well, how do we beat these guys? Because if JJ Smith, who played one of the best innings, you know, we talked about JP Kotze in World Cricket League 2 in Namibia, are great innings. Now, in terms of the context of this match, JJ Smith comes out and gets out, they lose that game. They're posting early hundreds, and that chase goes completely different. Some of the shots he played, and look, if you can get onto the highlights, it's going to be worth a few minutes of your time. He played one particular shot off a full fast ball that I think was the best shot that he played. It was. I remember watching one of those shorts in between innings where I think Michael Vaughan was throwing balls at Virat Kohli, and they were talking about how he plays the Yorker and is able to cock his wrists as the bat and be able to play the Yorker off the middle of the bat through backward point and through square point, where anyone else in the world is just going to bunt down it and get the base of the bat. The way that Smith was able to get his wrist down behind the ball, and it fairly rocketed away. I think we were watching it, we just couldn't believe how fast it was going to the boundary. And if you watch the highlights, I hope it's in there, you see him hitting sixes over cover, which is great to see, going over extra cover, and then a straight one that I think almost went out of the stadium. And I'm not exaggerating there at all. Just JJ Smith, how good and how big could he be in global cricket?
Yeah, I think that shot you're talking about is one that's really going to stick in the mind from this tournament. And it's an extraordinary skill to have. As you say, a Yorker-length ball, really wasn't very much wrong with it at all. And just the incredible bat speed that he must have got behind that to ping off, you know, what was still, you know, yeah, the middle of the bat, but, you know, vertically down at the bottom. And still, it absolutely screamed across the grass to the rope. And as a bowler, I think you hit what you think is a pretty decent Yorker, and you watch it pinging away through points of the rope like that. That's a pretty debilitating experience, I imagine. And I don't care who you are in world cricket, if someone hits you that way, it's hard to come back from.
So we've got a little bit of news that's just popped up on our screens that we'll get to. Let's just wrap up this looking forward to Oman, Hong Kong. Again, as I thought last night, the team that batted first would win with runs on the board. I really think it's the same again tonight. So I don't want to say who's going to win, because I really think who's got the runs on the board will get up. And of course, that's going to be Hong Kong either way. So that's my tip. Burtis, how are you seeing it?
Yeah, well, it's all good to say bat first and runs on the board, but... You say calling a coin correctly is arguably easier than putting runs on the board. You can bat first and post 115 or 120, and then suddenly it's a completely different ball game. Yeah, I mean, I think it's heart says Hong Kong, maybe head says Oman. The quality in this Oman side we haven't really seen yet this tournament. And despite, I think, that Hong Kong do have the psychological advantage that they're the team that wanted, that's happy to be playing this game. And every chance, definitely, the quality's there at the top of the order. The depth maybe is not. But with this Oman side, there's a lot of players that can hurt you. I think Oman just shades it for me.
Thanks for that. I won't be asking you any more questions then. Well, not solemn news, not surprising news at all. The Emirates Cricket Board has just put an official statement on their website within the last few minutes, where it's 6:45 golf time, that they're confirming that the wicketkeeper batter Ghulam Shabir, who absconded, went AWOL early in the morning of Monday the 21st, and was, well, first they were really worried about his safety because he hadn't told anyone that he was leaving. So I think they had the police on call. Then he turned up in Pakistan. They've actually confirmed that, well, he's been suspended for absconding, and the board also confirms that he's part of the current and ongoing ICC anti-corruption investigation. Now, there was a certain investigative journalist documentary done by Al Jazeera, and it has been well, I'd say not swept aside, but it was, I think the ICC basically said it was, a lot of it was baseless, but they were looking to engage with that network to try and share information, but I'm not sure how far they got with that, and I think we're waiting for a statement from the ICC soon on that. But the fixer, if you haven't seen it, spoke to the undercover journalist, who was David Harrison, if I'm remembering correctly, and they said that they had the UAE team in their hands being able to fix sections or matches, and they said they had five players. This is now the fifth player suspended in relation to anti-corruption investigations. Just, what does this mean, and what is this? How do you react to this, Bertus?
Well, obviously, it's perhaps not hugely surprising. Though it is interesting now that the ECB are confirming that he was at least a part of the ongoing ICC anti-corruption probe. When previously, I think it was reported in the National that the ECB had put out a statement saying that he was not a part of the investigation, or at least was not a subject of the investigation. Now, whether this is some word trickery and say that he was not a suspect in the investigation, but he was somehow involved, it's hard to say. It's possible that, I mean, maybe this is just a flat contradiction of the earlier statement. It's, again, disappointing communications-wise, but legally speaking, of course, boards are somewhat have their hands tied in terms of what they can and can't say. But yeah, it's just, it's hugely disappointing for the game. And we were talking earlier after the game about Paul Radley asked the UAE captain Ahmed Raza in the press conference whether he had anything he wanted to say about it. And he did rather dodge that question. But just from the perspective of the rest of the UAE team, it must be just so incredibly disappointing. But the broader point is here that you have an extreme vulnerability in associates cricketers who are, broadly speaking, not well paid, especially the younger ones who can often be naive. They come from various backgrounds, and not all of them are equipped to deal with these approaches. And it's all very well imposing penalties, and it's all very well imposing suspensions and the like, but punishment is not the same as prevention.
Yeah, and I don't want to go back over the same ground. I know we've spoken about this a lot, and we'll go into this more in depth in the regular weekly podcast that will be out on Friday. But yeah, this goes deeper to education and pastoral care for players early on, and that's also including support for developing cricket nations. You know, we've mentioned this over and over, and there are corrupt approaches being reported in women's cricket. And this is something that the game really needs to get a handle on. Well, not so much get a handle on, because I think we know what's going on, but to manage, because, you know, we're going through some betting numbers, and again, I'm probably off here, but there's about 10 times as much bet on the T20 qualifier matches yesterday as the Rugby World Cup semi-finals were. That might just say, because of the variety and options of betting in a cricket match is more attractive to the gambling market, where professional gamblers can find value. But when it comes down to it, the fact that there's that much money being gambled on cricket matches means that cricket is more open to nefarious influences behind the scenes trying to manipulate and influence results. So something we can go into more detail in the future. But for now, we can move to something that's a little bit more pleasing, or a little bit, well, less depressing perhaps, is that after Paris Khadka announced his retirement from the captaincy, only he'll continue playing, but he's retired from leading the Nepal men's team, Cricket Association Nepal have announced that Gyanendra Malla has been appointed, quote unquote, until further notice. So that sounds a little bit temporary, but this is a little bit surprising that Malla hasn't played in the team for a little while, Bertus.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to say too much about it. I'm sure that the boys will have plenty to talk about when you guys get back to your regular pod. Yeah, I was perhaps a little surprised in that, of course, Malla has missed a couple of tours. His form has been somewhat patchy, and he perhaps one of these players that hasn't really, of late, maybe his grip on his place in the team had been slipping. But on the other hand, I mean, he's been an impressive servant of Nepal cricket for a number of years. He's had the vice captaincy role on and off under Kadka for much of that as well. And he is a class player. Some people, we've seen with Anshi, of course, and we saw with Navneet Dhaliwal for Canada. Some people absolutely thrive under the captaincy. So, replacing Paris Kadka, huge shoes to fill. And perhaps asking one of the younger players, bearing in mind that a lot of the senior players, bar the bowlers, are rotated in and out of the side at the moment. We saw, Sharad Vasaka also not a guaranteed pick. So you want to give it to a senior player with a lot of experience and who's had a senior role in the side before, then perhaps Yamala is a natural pick.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head with any podcast that has Daniel Beswick and Nepal mentioned. I am sure we will go into depth. So have a look for that when that is released on Friday morning, GMT, and also on 91.3 Sport FM in Perth. We need to get back to the ground. It's 10 to 7 and the game starts in 40 minutes. So, well, hopefully as you listen to this, you see Hong Kong putting in a winning performance for one of the great, or come from behind, or Cinderella story, as I said in the in my review of the Nigeria game. So thank you for listening and hoping you're enjoying all the coverage on emergingcricket.com. And from Bertus de Jong and myself, Tim Cutler, I'm going to wish you all an enjoyable night watching Hong Kong win. And we look forward to coming to you soon.